Getting down seems like a good time to start. You always look for these little indicators. Morning, folks.
Morning.
Thanks for coming back. It's a problem with freedom, is people can freely choose to opt out, right? So, great to see you all. I hope yesterday was a little bit helpful. We had a great talk back, I thought. Nice turnout and lively discussion. And certain things emerged during the talk back. I asked people toward the end, okay, after the first talk, anything that you'd like me to try to weave in the rest of the week? So I had a half a dozen suggestions, and I'll weave in a few today and a few tomorrow and a few the next day, which is appropriate to each theme. Someone also asked me about a bibliography. I don't have an exhaustive one. I do have one page, maybe about 15 citations, not all the citations. For instance, I noticed I didn't put anything on Merton here, but you can Google Merton and get everything. So I do have about 20 sheets of bibliography, if that's of interest to you, one page. So a couple things that came out in the talk back that I want to put out at the beginning, and then we'll go from there, and we'll start today's, clean up yesterday at the end, and then start today. So one of the things that came up that I didn't say yesterday that I encouraged, but it might have been subtly implied by what I said yesterday, sharing my personal journey, is I encouraged those of you who came to Unitarian Universalism from another tradition, or maybe no tradition at all, but which is more and more the case, I find, with the younger generation, but maybe for the older generation, it's more like you came from some tradition to UU. And I would encourage you, as best you are able, if you're able, some aren't, to not sever from that past totally, to in some way interact with that past and bring with you into Unitarian Universalism whatever from that past still is very important to you. When I first got to Pittsburgh at Allegheny in 1991, Kirk Lodeman Copeland, a great friend and colleague and South Hills minister, said to me that he had a lot of Catholics in his congregation. Could I come and speak to them about this transition? And I said I could, but of course after I hung up, I realized I had never thought that through myself, so I had to start working on it. What would I say to these people? How did I make that transition? But it was a wonderful exercise. It forced me to do that homework and realize what I had already discarded and what was still fundamental to me. And if it wasn't obvious yesterday, you probably realize that in my own spiritual journey into Unitarian Universalism, there's a foundation there that's still very, very potent for me and that I brought with me. So if you've never gone through that exercise or you... Now, when I got to South Hills, I realized that a lot of people had never done that. And in fact, they were in UU, they were comfortable with it, but there was all this stuff from the back and they didn't know what to do with it. And so this talk, whatever I said, it helped free them up. And I'll just share one quick anecdote. One of the women said, we had a little talk back, and one of the women said, do you know that 3 years ago I found out I had cancer, and it was serious cancer, and I was distraught, and I didn't know what to do, and I was lost. And a friend of mine said, well, Mary, don't you remember we grew up praying the rosary? Why don't you start praying the rosary again, a pious Catholic practice that many of us grew up with? And she said, the rosary, really? And of course, like most ex-Catholics or former Catholics or, you know, you never throw away rosary beads, so they're always there in some draw. You just have to remember which draw the rosary beads are in, right? But they're there. They never get thrown away. So she picked out her rosary beads and started doing the rosary. Now, her theology had changed, and she realized she didn't say exactly the same things, but just that practice of going through the beads for her was very centering and very, very helpful. And so she stood up, and she shared that story, and she said, I've never told any of my Unitarian Universalist friends about this, but that's what I do. And there were other stories like that. I go into church, I genuflect, I pray. While I'm jogging, I leave, I make sure no one sees me, and first time I've ever admitted this, so it's great. So I just encourage you, if there's anything there from the past, figure out how to bring it with you and incorporate it into your own theology now. Another thing that came up is yesterday I had a great conversation with someone at lunch who said, you know, My minister gave a sermon recently in which he said, doing social justice for me, the minister said, is very hard. It exhausts me. It is not easy. I put all my energy into it and I'm wiped out. It's just really hard path for me to follow, even though I do it, and I know it's central to congregational life. So what I wanted to say about that is, because a wonderful anecdote, is that, and I think Gandhi's really good in this, at least the Hindu tradition, but I want to say it was Gandhi, at least whom I learned it from, that there are different spiritual paths. So when we talk about social justice as a spiritual path, we're not implying that for every person that is your central or main spiritual path, or it ought to be. That's not what we're saying. What we're trying to accomplish this week is to suggest that it's a central UU path, but there are other paths, and that most especially institutionally or for congregational life, social justice needs to be a central part of what you do as a congregation. Not just some separate little, there are those five people, they're the activists. That's what we're trying to overcome. Okay, and bring it into the center of the congregation, as we would do with pastoral care and celebration, worship, and religious education, and so forth. Social justice needs to be in that same space. But for individuals, no. For some, it's the intellectual life, which is their spiritual path. Or the meditative, the prayer life is their main spiritual path. Or the path of love, and so forth. So the Hindus are really good at this. Gandhi spoke about it a lot. And for some, it's action. And Gandhi, for him, although he was very contemplative, action was his spiritual path. So if it's not your spiritual path and it's hard for you to do, not to worry. But know that for Unitarian Universalism, as I read it, it ought to be a key central path for our movement and for congregations. The other thing that came up is, so Art, what did you do between Army and the seminary? Well, just briefly, I guess I thought I said something, but I started reading Dan Berrigan voraciously, everything he wrote in the 70, 71. I moved into a section of Boston called Roxbury, which is inner city, and I started hanging out with a lot of sisters and priests who were doing amazing work in the inner city as Roxbury was falling apart. As Christopher Hedges, a national commentator now, calls a killing zone. It's one of the killing zones, sacrifice zones in Boston, Roxbury, and always has been, and still is in some ways. And so I was mentored by a lot of priests who had dug into that part of the city and had an amazing presence in the midst of big, big challenges. So I did that for 2 years and then off to the seminary. So that's that. Now, just to clean up yesterday what I didn't get to about this fellow Merton, but more especially his perspective, this paradox of the importance of the monastery. And it can be literally taken or it can be a metaphor. You know, I mean, there are monasteries in the world, in the city that are, you know, people think of themselves as monks on the street and so forth. But this whole paradigm of the role of the monk as a critic at its best, this was Merton. A lot of monks don't do this, but to see clearly, to see through lies, to see illusions. That's how Merton saw the role of monasticism. While acknowledging that monastic life could indeed become a form of escape for individuals, Merton argued that the real job is to be free to see the world as it really is and to speak the truth about it. Merton was fond of saying that the monastic life, in its simplicity, austerity, and clarity, represents a protest against the world of materialism, of overbusiness, and violence. A protest. Monasticism, he goes on, is critical of the world, and as the monk deepens in her or his spiritual practice, she could actually see the world more clearly than most of us who are involved in the midst of it. And I mentioned yesterday, Merton had this interesting interaction with these Marxist students. He was giving a conference in California. And as I said yesterday, these Marxist students came up to him and said, you know, we're the real monks, not you people who have sort of withdrawn. We're the real monks. As we do our action and theory, you know, the Marxist thing of praxis, action, reflection, action theory, and so forth. We're the real monks. The only caveat, and Merton didn't fight them on that. He loved the idea that they saw it that way. But Merton's only caveat on that was, he said, as he reads Marxism, Merton, it calls for a change in economic structures, as we all know, a very, very important thing. It's where we get the concept of social justice, structural injustice, institutional violence. We used that expression yesterday. But Merton says the monk, Christian or Buddhist or whatever, works for a change in human consciousness. Human consciousness. Now, Marxism is generally read to say when the structures change, consciousness changes. It follows. But Merton said, no, not necessarily. And so the monk is working on getting clearer, working on human consciousness, seeing things more clearly. Not necessarily as a result of change in structures, but as a primary focus. The monastic vocation is to see more clearly, become more conscious, and to become fully realized as a person, and to then pass it on to others. And lastly, I'll leave you this quote from Merton, because this is where I think he gives us the most. And this isn't just for monks. This is a message for all of us from Merton. And it's in a book called Contemplation in a World of Action. Contemplation in a World of Action. And this is what he says. Simply this: she who attempts to act and do things for others or for the world without deepening her own self-understanding, freedom, integrity, and capacity to love will not have anything to give others. He will communicate to them nothing but the contagion of his own obsessions, his aggressiveness, his ego-centered ambitions, his delusions about ends and means, his doctrinaire prejudice and ideas. There is nothing more tragic, says Merton, in the modern world than the misuse of power and action to which men and women are driven by their own Faustian misunderstandings and misapprehensions. We have more power at our disposal today than we have ever had, and yet we are more alienated and estranged from the inner ground of meaning and love than we have ever been. The result of this is evident. We are living through the greatest crisis in our history, and the crisis is centered precisely in the country that has made a fetish out of action and has lost, or perhaps never had, the sense of contemplation. Far from being irrelevant, prayer, meditation, and contemplation are of utmost importance in America today. Action, contemplation, theory, reflection, the back and forth, that dialectic. That's Merton's gift. You know, another person who's really good in this, who probably some are more familiar with, is a fellow, and I can never say this because of Boston, the A's, Parker Palmer. See, if I did it fast, it would be Parker Palmer. Parker Palmer. He has a book called The Act of Life, and he focuses on the importance of contemplation and meditation for the world of action. And again, what is contemplation? Basically, to see more clearly, to see more clearly, to get rid of illusions about life, the world, and ultimately ourselves. Every year, up in Massachusetts, where I now live, Melanie and I live, and I serve this church in Essex, which is on the North Shore of Boston. A group of Buddhist monks come through marching. They do this march many hundreds of miles, and it takes them 2 months to do it, and they do it through, they start in early March, which up there can be snow weather, and they march 20, 25 miles a day, and they have hospitality along the way by people. So they always come through Essex, our town. They come to our church, and they have lunch or dinner and sometimes sleep over and then go on to the next stop. And their leader, Kato, this fellow from Japan, always goes into our sanctuary and spends a couple hours. The first thing he does when they arrive, And he reminds me every time he comes how important our sanctuary space is and how beautiful it is and how it helps him get centered for the next day of marching and why he's doing what he's doing, and hopefully that it's having some impact and effect. And for a Buddhist monk deeply immersed in trying to see the world clearly, to say that this universalist sanctuary is special to him is just an incredible honor and, you know, a wonderful moment for me to know that he gets that sort of experience in our church. And lastly, and this is one of the props, some of you from the past know this, the hat, right? I got this hat from two women who have a ministry in San Francisco, and if you don't know about it, maybe Google it and find out, but Kay Jurgensen, a UU minister, and Carmen Bassati, a Franciscan nun, have for many years, 20 years, I don't know, 25 years, had a ministry in San Francisco called the Faithful Fools. And it's a ministry. I knew someone would take this photo. I see that movie. Yeah, you have to have the right prop to get a photo op here, right? You know, so 25 years or so, Carmen and Kay have been doing this, what they call street ministry. And you Google Faithful Fools, the Faithful Fools. And these are contemplative people who every day go out with their hats on. You know, the jester, the court jester, who you know is the one who tells the truth, right? It's the jester who exposes all the chicanery and the lies and sees things really, really clearly. And the jester's a fool, right? And a, sort of a, you know, crazy. But if you listen closely, it's the jester who's always cutting through, as Uncle Andy would say, the rubbish. That's just rubbish. The jester cuts through that. So they're out there every day with their hats on doing what they call street retreats. Street retreats. And they walk the streets and interact with folks. And as our great theologian Thandekar says, has sacred encounters with people. They're not out there to fix people. Or what's your problem? Can I get you to something? They're there to have an encounter and to interact and say hello. And they're an incredible witness, and their meditation feeds their witness for justice and exposing poverty and the lies of the system. Wonderful, wonderful ministry, the Faithful Fools. So that's something that is part of our movement, our UU movement. So at any rate, today, congregations and social justice as a spiritual path. I've been really blessed, you know, having moved on from the Catholic tradition and gone to University of Pittsburgh for graduate studies, to stumble into this wonderful church in Pittsburgh, on the north side of Pittsburgh, Allegheny. So I've been blessed to have two churches in my 22 years in Unitarian Universalism. I can't tell you what a lucky guy I am. Lou Gehrig once said, the luckiest man alive or something, I don't know. So, and now up in Essex, Massachusetts, First Universalist in Essex. And so one of the reasons I'm so lucky is because both these churches allowed me to bring my own insights about ministry and social justice, community work as central to church life. They allowed me to bring that with me and to implement as best I could in the life of the church. And of course, as I said yesterday, part of that reason is that I didn't get much pushback is because in both cases they were very desperate. You know, both churches were very low in membership. Both churches had already started a dialogue about when will we close. You know, we don't have much money left, and maybe a couple of years. And so that dialogue had already begun in both churches. So it was a great situation to walk into, and so forth. And you know, the interesting thing is, even though they were desperate, they were still detractors. In each of the two churches, prominent members of these small groups didn't agree to this. I remember in Pittsburgh, and Leo's going to be able to figure this out, I suppose, but what I did with the handful of people, a dozen or 14 people, I interviewed them all, what do you think, and blah, blah, blah. And one person just said to me, Art, I bet you're a nice person, and you have the best of intentions, but I voted against this. I thought it was the worst idea we've ever had. Spending money on your salary is just a mistake. So sorry, that's the way I feel, but that's the way it is. So, but we got through it somehow. And And at one point in time, that person said, you know, I was wrong, which was great. And then up in Massachusetts, same dynamic, you know, a handful of people desperate, do whatever you think is best and so forth. In fact, one guy said, Arthur, I don't know what to tell you about how to get this church going. It's been on a downward slide for a long time. Maybe you should just, and it's sort of in this semi-rural area, not far from Boston, but not urban. And I'm an urban guy, I don't know. But so he said, I don't know what to tell you. Oh, maybe you should go walk down to the Dunkin' Donuts and just hang out and see who comes. And maybe that's the way to get things rolling, you know? And I said to myself, not to him, I am not going to Dunkin' Donuts and waiting for people to come in. There's got to be some other way to do this. But the oldest member of that congregation, who was really mad that they were spending his money on me, said not to me, but to his nephew. When the nephew said, well, what do you think of this new guy? He said, ah, that guy doesn't have a chance. So he died before he could say that he was wrong. But Elston. So I'm saying it for him posthumously. That was pretty bold, right? So at Allegheny in 91, they didn't ask me to be minister. They figured that was long past that. So they asked me to be director of social advocacy. And they just said, go in the neighborhood art. And this was their vision, the leadership. This was phenomenal. A small group of people, not young for the most part. Leo was, but most weren't. They just said, we want to make a contribution to the neighborhood before we die. And so you've got a couple of years of money and go for it, you know, just get into the neighborhood and let them know that we want to help in any way we can. That was their vision. This is a phenomenal story that I wish everyone knew. It's a great, great vision. So I was director of social advocacy for 4, 5, or 6 years, and then the congregation was doing better, and so they said, well, we'll add on the ministry part to it now. You're a minister and director of social advocacy. So they laid on the hands, and there I was. So, and the Essex Church, the Essex Church is in a little section where there are a lot of antique shops and a lot of former churches that are now antique shops. So one guy said, I don't care what happens here, I just don't want this church to turn into another antique shop. It's pretty funny. So, as I said yesterday, James Luther Adams helped me in this transition into UU. His theology, his brilliance, allowed me to make a connection to my own past, Catholic, Luther Adams, a Baptist, now a great Unitarian theologian. Reading him helped me. I can do this. I can be part of this. And one of his key insights, as I said yesterday, was from Channing, William Ellery Channing, who said that religion is a social principle, a social principle. This is what Channing in 1820 in a sermon said. Our own Unitarian Channing. Religion, we are told, is private, a personal thing, a concern between the individual and God. His neighbor or the community must not meddle with it. I would maintain, Channing goes on, that religion is eminently a social principle, entering into social life as having most important bearings on the public weal. On the public weal. The social character of religion is not sufficiently regarded. So this reluctant radical Channing came to this insight about religion as a social principle. And one of the quick things about Allegheny, by the way, that whole experience, and by the way, Allegheny now is a solid, small congregation with a good, long future facing it. Those people in those early years didn't focus on growth. They weren't saying, you got to grow this church, Art. They said, you've got to do something positive, Art, in the neighborhood. That's all they said. So my point is, their focus wasn't, how do we grow? How do we grow? How do we get people in here? How do we advertise? What's our niche? Blah, 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 blah. At one point, someone said to me, Art, your church should be the social justice church in Pittsburgh. That's your niche. Well, yeah, we do that, but no, we're a church, so that means we do many other things. But the point is, their focus was doing something positive in the community And if we grow as a byproduct, great. Then maybe, as the great wisdom teachers would say, I suppose, well, maybe you're doing something right if you're growing, you know. But as a byproduct, not as, and I would encourage you all to think that through. Don't spend a lot of time saying, how do we grow? How do we do it? What's the, you know, how do we get those people? No. Do something right. Live out Unitarian Universalism and let it happen. So yesterday at the talk back, we discussed the importance of having a theological foundation for social justice. The importance of grounding our social justice work, social justice as a spiritual practice, and that's why I think I call it that, in our theology, in our values, if theology doesn't work, in our values, our principles, if you will. Now, there are always going to be people in the congregation resisting social justice. I suspect most of you would find that. They see it as too political. They won't agree. Social justice, it makes things messy here in the church. That's why I think you need a theological foundation. In other words, it's not an option. Oh, we'll do social justice or we won't. But our theology, our values, as you ground us in that and say this has got to be a component of who we are and that it's central to UU. I know we don't like authority very much, but this is the time you whip out authority figures, you know, the Channings and the Parkers and the Emersons and the Adams and the Clarence Skinners and so forth, these great UU thinkers who said, no, this has got to be central to who we are, social justice. There was a debate in the 60s and 70s, and I think it's died out, but I think the remnants are still there. There was a movement called Unitarian Universalists for a Free Conscience, and I think it was sort of prominent in Pittsburgh a bit because there was an articulator of that view, and the view was church, social justice violated individual integrity. The job, you know, churches need to provide a space for individuals to go on their own spiritual search. To bring social justice into the mix is disruptive. People aren't going to agree and so forth, and that's not what we do in church. So if you want to do social justice, join the ACLU or Amnesty International or some other local hunger group or something, but don't bring it in here. This is for individuals to have their own spiritual journey and not be distracted by social issues, which are contentious. The other point I want to make about the importance of a theological foundation for social justice as a spiritual path is that too often I hear, and I've heard it in my congregation up in Massachusetts, not so much at Allegheny, but maybe it was more hidden there, but up there is we've got some people who have said to me, one in particular who really has sort of disappeared, I guess, in some ways. You know, Art, this church is too democratic. I'm a Republican. And I know some of you have dealt with that, right? And we don't want to go there. We are not Democrats or Republicans or Green Party. We're not that as you use. Our social justice and therefore the social implications and our political action, if you will, flow from our theology, our values, not because we're Democrats and Republicans. I gave a sermon on universal health care. This person vehemently disagreed with it, but she disagreed with it because she thought that I was articulating a democratic platform. And as a Republican, she disagreed with it. And she said, I feel isolated here. There are too many Democrats, only a few Republicans. First of all, I tried to point out all the other Republicans to her. No, there are others. But I tried to say, but that's not why I preached that sermon. It had nothing to do with the democratic platform. I'm not even sure what that is. No, it comes out of our faith, our theology, our values as you use. But I didn't get through. I didn't get through, unfortunately, and I think we lost her. But this is another reason why I think the foundation needs to be our faith, our theology, and not that we look like we're Democrats or Green Party or whatever our affiliation is as a political party. So this whole idea of free conscience and individual, I think this individualism gets us stuck, though. You know, we live in a country which, in some ways, has this problem of radical individualism. And I think, actually, it's getting more pronounced. it comes out politically, I think it does, in what's called libertarianism. And I think there's a growing body of people who suggest that they're libertarians. Maybe a bunch here. I don't know if you're a libertarian. But I think it's part of this radically individualist culture, different than Western Europe, different than Canada, I think, culturally, this radical individualism. And Unitarian Universalism has this issue, I think, because, for good reasons, because we have so much respect for individual integrity. So if you look at our principles, that first principle about individual respecting individual integrity, this is wonderful. I'm not criticizing, that's a wonderful thing, individual integrity. But I don't think, and I am criticizing this, that when it translates into a radical individualism, that I don't think that's the way for us to go, or as Unitarian Universalists, that's our path. One of the people who's really good on this is a sociologist named Robert Bellah, B-E-L-L-A-H, who in the 80s wrote a book called The Habits of the Heart about radical individualism in this country and how it was a problem for democracy, radical individualism. I don't have time to explain all that, but we'll touch upon it as the week goes on. It's a very important study, and there's a follow-up to it, Robert Bellah. Our own Fred Muir, who's our minister in Maryland at Annapolis, has written an article, I think it was in the winter 2012 World magazine, Fred Muir. It was the Berry Street lecture, which is a lecture mostly for ministers at the GA every year. And Fred cites this problem in UU. Actually, Fred said we have three issues that we've got to overcome in UU. One is radical individualism. Second is our authority problem. And I just did a Jesse Cavalier in that one, didn't I? And thirdly, our exceptionalism. You know, like we're different. You know, the bumper sticker. The uncommon denomination. Eesh. So anyway, Fred said we have these three issues that we've got obstacles we have to overcome. But I'm focusing on individualism. And this whole idea that if you take on social justice, you're violating someone's conscience because they don't agree. They don't agree. No, on that issue or whatever. So it's dicey, but it can't be avoided, I don't think. All you can do is have good dialogue and respectfully allow people to dissent and so forth, but don't let it be an obstacle to moving ahead. You know, we can't do that because Jack objects or Jill objects and so forth. You know that. And we can't let that happen to us. It's a violation, I think, of our covenant as a community. So we need to work on the notion of common good, which isn't something that we have a good sense of. And Fred Muir, in this article, Winter 2012, writes about it. We don't have good language in UU for common good. We do for individual integrity, but not common good. And this is where the Catholics are pretty good, by the way. They have a long tradition of collective thinking, sometimes for the worst reasons, but in this case, the common good. Defining it's challenging, I understand, but the notion of the common good. Dr. King would call it the beloved community. He inherited that notion from a philosopher named Josiah Royce, the beloved community. But collective thinking, we need more collective thinking in UU. We've got the individual thing down pretty well. You know, I believe what I believe. But not so much collective thinking. And you know, there was a very interesting dialogue. This fellow in the Republican Party, Paul Ryan, who's a young, you know, articulator of a certain vision of society. If you followed Paul Ryan, he basically said many times when he was articulating his social policy vision for the Republican Party that he was getting this from Catholic social principles. Well, a group of about 14,000, no, only a couple hundred, but there probably could have been 14,000 Catholic theologians and priests and nuns and ministers and blah, 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 thinkers, wrote a beautiful 5-page response saying that Paul Ryan, fine fellow, I'm sure a good Catholic in his own mind, but his articulation of Catholic social principles is way, way off. And this is what the Catholic Church teaches about the common good and about social inequality. And this is not what Paul Ryan is selling. So it's a fabulous response. I have the citation if you need it to that whole platform and how it isn't a Catholic social teaching. So this whole question of grounding our social justice in our faith, our theology, our principles. I often, when we read our principles at our current church, and I think I did this at Allegheny a few times, is I read them backwards, bottom up. Now, I don't have them in front of me, and I'm embarrassed to say I haven't memorized them, but the last one is a collective vision, right? And someone will tell me about it later. But the last one, the seventh principle, is a collective vision. Interdependent web, is that the seventh? I don't know. Yep. And so I often have people read from the bottom up. And so my angle on that, which everyone necessarily wouldn't agree with, is we're social beings, that much of who we are, and this, for a radical individualist, no, that's not true. Much of who we are, I believe, and I think there's good sociology on this, although disagreements. Durkheim's a good one on this, sociologist. We're social beings. We're so much shaped by our surroundings, our you know, our families, our communities, blah, 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 blah. We're social beings. And the best of us emerges in our social interactions, in relationships and so forth. That's a belief. I'm putting that out there. You could easily disagree with that. Some would say, no, no, no. I'm an island. I'm individual. I reject every social belonging I've ever had and so forth and so on. But I suggest every once in a while read the principles backwards or bottom up. And the last one being integrity. Important one, but still maybe the last one. So this is where PowerPoint would come in great. And I'm a real Luddite. I don't do this. Actually, is it Matt? Cliff, who's the... Last year, Cliff was really working hard because Meg Riley, who's a lot smarter than I am and much more savvy on this stuff, I guess had all sorts of... And, you know, here I am. If there was a chalkboard here, I'd probably use it. But so if I had PowerPoint, this would be more helpful. But Dick Gilbert, a wonderful UU minister and a good friend up from Rochester, who's done great work on social justice as a spiritual practice, in his book Prophetic Imperative. Well, anyway, Dick has this, it's called Gilbert's Wheel. It's this big circle. And in the center is... Center of Unitarian Universalist Life is celebration. You could call it worship, but he calls it celebration, celebration of worship, when we come together to, you know, celebrate or worship. And then the spokes around are religious education, pastoral care, and social justice. And it's in the circle. So Dick's point in constructing this image is simply to be a full, what do we call, what's the expression, a full functioning church? That's not it, but something like a full service church, I guess. Then you have celebration. You come together to celebrate. You do pastoral care for the congregation. You do religious ed, children and adults, and you do social justice. And that's a full congregation. So the point of that wheel is that social justice is equally as important as pastoral care, RE, and worship. That's what he's trying to accomplish. So it's and I was part of a program which I think has been decommissioned. As far as I know, it's been defunded. But it ran for 20 years, called the Social Justice Empowerment Program. Now, I've been in a lot of Ohio churches and the Pittsburgh churches as a trainer for that social justice empowerment. About 200 out of the 1,000 congregations have done it. And one of our key pieces of ideology is social justice needs to be a key component of the church and weaved into every part of church life. So we want to overcome this idea that the Social Justice Committee, those five lunatics over there who won't shut up, and every time there's an announcement, they have to have a place, you know. That's what we're trying to overcome. We want to bring those five into the center of congregational life and have the minister and the RE director weave social justice in to our faith life. And so that it's a key component, not an option. Oh, that's the church that does social justice. And I say, compared to what? No, no, no. UU theology, it's just as important as RE, pastoral care, and so forth. So, nuts. Problem with doing these kind of things is I'm having too much fun and it's ending. So we've got about... 8 minutes, okay. So, when we do these workshops, we say there are five types. There are five components to doing justice, social justice. We say education, service, witness, advocacy, and community organizing. Education, we generally do pretty well. Adult ed, we read, we think, we analyze. That's important because you have to analyze before you act to make sure you're heading in the right direction. Service, we do pretty well. You know, we go to food pantries, we gather clothing, we take care of material needs that surface. But as came in yesterday, and this will be a weave-in to a question yesterday that you may have asked, but maybe not. How do we do social service in a way that's not demeaning or patronizing and so forth? You know, we're going to help those people and that kind of thing. You know, those poor, unfortunate people, we're going to help them and so forth. Terrible, terrible approach. Stay out of that. And if you sense it's going on, try to nip it in the bud. But our theologian, Thandeka, who I encourage you to read anything this woman writes, she's a somewhat controversial figure in our movement because people don't always agree with her insights on race and class. And she's an African-American thinker, philosopher, theologian, who's got some brilliant insights, I think. And she's been in the world a number of times over the years. She has an amazing little article in 1994 in the World about a friend of hers, a middle-class African-American woman who worked with welfare recipients, almost all African-American, and thought she would help them. And so that was the attitude she brought. I'm middle class, I'm educated, blah, 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 blah. We're all black here, so of course we have an immediate identity, and I'm going to make their lives better. And she tells the story, Thandeka, that her friend said, I utterly failed at this because of my approach. She said, as it turned out, I had nothing in common with these welfare recipients, almost all. We were all women, we were all African-American, but my upper middle class education and my attitude about my relationship with them went nowhere. We had nothing in common, she said. It was a terrible revelation in a way to her. And she realized that there was a class division that she wasn't overcoming well. And so Thandeka draws this conclusion that that's not the way you do social service. It's not a sacred encounter. She has this wonderful expression, the importance in our relationships of sacred encounters. That means respecting one another and entering into relationships that are, we learn from one another, we respect one another, and so forth. And this woman realized she wasn't respecting them. She was helping them. She was going to fix them. So we do social service, but it's important how we do it. We do witness. We went to Phoenix, GA last year, and we were out there. We were marching. We had our sign, standing on the sign of love. We stand for something. That's a good witness. Fourth, we do advocacy, which is often understood as lobbying. We lobby on bills. You might know now that in Congress, a bill just passed, a farm bill that didn't have the food stamp piece in it, so it's a big controversy. There's a big fight going on because food stamps are about to be slashed radically, drastically, and so forth. So that wouldn't be a bad issue to start lobbying on, you know, getting food stamps for people who in many cases are desperate. And so, and we can lobby, by the way. We're 501c3. You know, we're tax deductible. No, that's not the expression. Tax exempt. Thank you. And but we can lobby. You know, it's very much in the IRS codes. You can lobby 5 or 10% of what your ministry is, and so no one's counting percentages. You can lobby. You can't lobby for a candidate. Okay, that's a violation. But you can lobby on issues, on bills, and so forth. And lastly, and this is what I spent, God bless you, most of my time doing, community organizing. Community organizing. It was asked yesterday about nationally how we're doing. Community organizers, there are these big networks nationally, and traditionally community organizers like Saul Alinsky back in the 30s and 40s did local stuff. Community organizing networks, and 200 or at least 150 UU congregations are in community organizing networks. In Pittsburgh, there's PIN. In Ohio, in Columbus, there's BREAD, and maybe other cities. But those networks are starting to take on national issues. So our group, we're doing local stuff, but we're also doing immigration reform. Our network worked on healthcare reform that passed 2 years ago and so forth. So the importance, because decisions get made at the regional and national level, and we've got to be on that. So my experience, community organizing in these networks is one way to really do that beyond the local community. And, of course, the UUA, which is recently restructuring, is doing work, and I'm not on top of all that, but the service committee and the UUA social justice branch in the last couple of years have started working much more closely together. And I don't have time to do it now, but maybe I can pick up here in the morning. There are ways, how do you pick issues? You know, what's the process by which you go through to pick issues when you're going to do community organizing and social justice? So I'll just leave you, I guess, with this thought, and then we'll have the talk back and pick up with this tomorrow. And maybe tomorrow we'll try to define a little bit better how we understand justice and how we see justice. And a good question from Paul was, you know, how about people see justice differently? What for someone is an injustice isn't for another person, and so our perspective. We'll talk about that Wednesday and most especially Thursday, how we deal with that issue. But I'll leave you with this little anecdote, I guess, and that is when I was at Allegheny, I put up on our bulletin board at the top, you know, we had the sermon title every week, but at the top, the phrase that never changed was, we are a religious community focused on reflection and social justice. I don't know what we said, but something like that. But the key thing was, I put that up there, religious community. And one of the members of the congregation came to me and said, Art, religious, could you change that to spiritual? Which was very interesting, and I did. I didn't want to. But I didn't also want to get in. I didn't think it mattered all that much, but it does matter in some ways. So I violated myself in a way. But what I'm trying to get at this week is, and there was a woman at GA, by the way, who's written a book called When Spiritual, Not Religious, Is Not Enough. The book is circulating. Her name is Daniel, Lillian Daniel. And she gave a big speech at the General Assembly this year. She's a minister. She said, when spiritual, not religious, you know, that's a phrase out there a lot now. I'm spiritual, not religious. Usually means I don't go to church. Usually. Not always. But it's often people saying, no, God, yeah, I'm okay with God, and I'm spiritual, but I just, yeah, religious community, yeah. So, but the religious part, and that's why I put it in there, is the institutional part. And if we're serious about social justice, making change, we need institutions, because later in the week I'll talk about institutions and power, and no social change will happen without exercising power. And institutions, individuals cannot do it. And so when I use the word religion, I'm saying we need institutions that work for the common good. And those are religions. And so for me, to be spiritual and religious is fine. That works great. But, you know, I'm spiritual, not religious. That tells me you're on your individual journey, which is fine, but it ain't enough. And it means that maybe you're not so aware that institutions are going to make change, not individuals.